you. We can ask questions. Thank you very much, Immaculée. What Immaculée didn't tell you is that she also spearheaded a campaign at the UN Security Council to have the chief prosecutor move from the ICTR and to get an independent prosecutor for the ICTR, because we had thought that we had reached a dead end. We could not. There was too much insensitivity, particularly on crimes that had been committed against women. So,
excusez-moi, Betty, j'en ai parlé. Peut-être que je n'ai pas donné de détails, mais j'ai fait signer 60 organisations rwandaises une pétition comme quoi Carla Del Ponte ne devait pas revenir au tribunal. Malheureusement, elle est partie, c'est vrai, mais on n'a pas vu beaucoup de changements. Voilà. Je ne sais même pas si aujourd'hui j'aurai encore le courage de faire signer des pétitions et de partir à l'aventure à New York. National Security Council.
All right, so we can, you know, comments or questions. Jessica.
Thank you very much, Betty, and thank you, Immaculée, for sharing with us. The ICC is a mechanism that I support, but in the case of Uganda, it is very difficult. First of all, as you say, we all doubt the sincerity of the person who referred the case. And now that same person is saying, I don't have to keep the case there. That actually has put a potential of discrediting the ICC. If all these countries fail to arrest these people, refuse in fact to arrest these people, and in fact I think we were together when we went to Northern Uganda and the RDC, the Resident District Commissioner, said we can even refuse to cooperate with the ICC. Now these are the same people who took the case to the ICC in the first place. I think in future the prosecutor has to be more careful in deciding what cases he's going to take up, especially because he first looks at the evidence. Mm-hmm. And the case of Northern Uganda, considering that these are atrocities that have been going on since 1986, to think that a mechanism of 2002 can bring justice to many people was potentially a big problem. And that is why it has never in Northern Uganda gained much credibility. Actually, that is my comment. My question is on the reparations. It probably is not even a question, it's a comment also. Because when we looked at the reparations last time, Ruth and I found that there was only 500,000 euro, and it wasn't for Uganda, it was for the whole world. And if this is a process that is given, that is contributed to voluntarily, how are we going to get the money even for community reparations, let alone individual ones? Mm.
I have a question. I couldn't get the point of the participation of witness and victim. So if you kindly re-explain it.
I also wanted to know which prosecutor, which chief prosecutor you wanted ousted.
Betty, j'ai suivi avec attention. J'ai suivi avec beaucoup d'attention votre intervention. C'est vrai que moi aussi, je suis un peu de près ce qui se passe à la Cour pénale internationale. Mais dans mon pays, quand tu parles de la Cour pénale internationale, c'est quelque chose qu'on ne croit pas tellement. Puisqu'on s'est dit qu'on a commencé à prendre, c'est-à-dire celui qui est à la base, au lieu de prendre ceux qui ont été vraiment impliqués dans le massacre qui ont eu lieu au Congo. Et la population se demande que représente l'action de Thomas Lubanga exactement, puisque pour la population, la Cour pénale internationale voudrait faire un semblant de procès en berçant les vrais responsables pour dire qu'elle fait un travail. Pour le Congo, surtout la société civile en général, nous, on a besoin d'un tribunal pénal international et non de la Cour pénale internationale. Puisque le tribunal pénal international va faire justice à tout le monde, alors que la Cour pénale internationale est limitée à certains crimes, c'est comme si elle couvrait certaines personnes qui ont commis des atrocités au pays. Et nous disons aussi, le fait que même les enquêteurs là viennent sans pour autant trop associer les Congolais, c'est comme si ce sont des étrangers qui viennent enquêter et qui n'intéressent pas les autochtones. Moi, j'aurais souhaité que la Cour pénale internationale fasse une forte pression sur les pays signataires du statut de Rome pour prendre des mesures d'application dans leur propre pays. Ça aurait été plus intéressant et les populations de ces pays pouvaient suivre de près le procès même. On a vu pendant une ou deux minutes Thomas Lubanga et rien de plus. Vous croyez vraiment que nos populations là peuvent croire à ce que la Cour pénale internationale fait? Et même cette sensibilisation n'est pas bien faite, puisque la société civile trouve qu'elle n'est pas tellement impliquée dedans. C'est vraiment un problème pour la réussite de cette Cour pénale internationale. Je voudrais avoir un peu ton point de vue là-dessus, toi qui es impliqué.
Merci beaucoup, Betty, pour votre exposé. Et mes questions portent sur le fonctionnement et l'efficacité de la Cour pénale internationale. La première question, c'est que j'aimerais savoir si le procureur peut mener des enquêtes de son initiative ou bien s'il entend qu'il y ait une demande du pays signataire et sur un cas précis. La deuxième question, j'aimerais savoir combien de cas que la Cour a connu depuis sa mise en application. Et s'il y en a, qu'est-ce qui a été le résultat? Merci.
Thank you very much, Betty, for that presentation. It's the first ICC presentation I've sat through. Because most of the time, the ones I had been part of on transitional justice were in the north. And, you know, these personal reactions, you don't know how to understand or interpret what you are told. I was always very uncomfortable and actually very fearful on the question of transitional justice in as far as our region is concerned. I have two comments, and it is still a struggle for me. I want on one hand to acknowledge and say that I think it's a good thing, because I think for the first time, just rape being classified as a crime against humanity was a point of celebration. I really thought it was a big breakthrough. And much as there are going to be those difficulties, with the prosecution, the court process and litigation. I think that's where our work to help to ensure that convictions are actually made by preparing victims right at home. Because they are not just going to wake up and go. I mean, I think the work we are doing on documentation has to be even more thorough, and the pressure to lobby for them to go, but to follow there and be the support to be sure. It has to take experts like you. It's not going to take a neat, you know, this is law, and it is so specialized that perhaps that's where I'm feeling that the gap is going to be very big for women and very gender committed legal minds. Honestly, take that ICC and the ICTR and all of them to task to make sure that we get convictions. Otherwise, those negative experiences of victims is going to leave us much more demoralized and feeling like we can never access justice. So I just wanted to suggest that we should not see it as an instead of, but to give us hope that if we don't access justice here, there is a place to go. But we have to continue intensifying the training of legal experts on gender and ICC. There are very few. And if we continue to go there and lose cases, I think we are going to be creating a monster for ourselves. So I think that ICC Week, we need to continue to prepare a cohort of people of Betty's type from the region, because this is also where the atrocities have come from. And then I wanted to say that we must guard against compensation, reparation, honestly, not only to mean financial or monetary compensation. I think we've said that it is so important as we prepare even the victims who are willing to go to the international court to understand that even service, rehabilitation, are as important. Just the fact that they have been given a hearing is so valuable, so that we don't also live here with victims thinking that, you know, compensation in terms of money, and then we end up being much more disappointed and killing their spirit to want to seek justice. Mm.
Well, thank you. I think I'll start with Mary's points, because I think they resonate very much with the kind of work that I've been doing for a long time now. There are two groups that have, they're international groups, but they have regional and work with lawyers and organizations in the countries in which they are in ICC investigations. One is the Women's Initiative for Gender Justice, which is based at The Hague, and it monitors prosecutions and investigations by the courts. The other older group that has done a lot of work in the ad hoc tribunals is the Coalition for Women in Conflict Situations. Now, I have been a member of both groups, and with the Coalition of Women's Rights in Conflict, we actually had to file an amicus curiae brief in the case of Akayesu, which is now much celebrated. How this happened, working with the Immaculée and groups in Rwanda like Avega and Profem, we managed to collect statements of women who had suffered sexual violence in Taba, because the indictment of Akayesu, the initial indictment, did not contain a charge of rape. And working beneath the radar, we collected statements, prepared careful legal documentation of this, as you suggest, and made a filing of the amicus curiae brief, which was instantly dismissed, but it is there and it is on record. However, at the close of the prosecution case, the prosecutor himself decided to amend the indictment and include rape as a charge against Akayesu because people were complaining. And then they said, oh, you know, it's not because the women made noise. Of course it was because the women made noise. In this Lubanga, and I'm coming to Rose's question, there is no charge of rape. Who does not know that the women of the DRC were raped and taken into sexual slavery and violated in the most outrageous manner? They have not included a charge of rape against this fake trial, as Rose puts it. You know? So what the Women's Initiative for Gender Justice has done, and Jessica now sits on the board of that organization, Ruth and I are advisors of that group, is they have done a similar thing. They have quietly, with civil society, women's organizations, collected testimonies from women who suffered rape and sexual violence. And they have last week made a filing in the ICC asking the prosecutor to consider including a charge of rape. But in the meantime, they will have an amicus curiae brief ready to file in the case, Lubanga is not charged with rape. So you are completely correct. I think it is important that we continue to monitor the work of these prosecutors. It is specialized, and we are very happy. I think Jessica is very happy where she's sitting, that you have also suggested that we do a training of what you call a cohort, because that was also a need that was identified at a previous meeting, and that is why we have, in fact, published this material, so that we can do that training, and hopefully a couple of lawyers and ACT people will take it seriously so that they can do the work in the communities. It's not just lawyers, because we need to work with other people who are good documenters, statement takers, and people like those who are interested in the work. Now, moving on to the question of reparations, yes, it's a problem, you know. How will we even do the rehab? How will the court do the rehabilitation with 500,000 euros? But whose responsibility it is? Is it? If the trust fund is going to rely on voluntary contributions, then it can't be voluntary contributions of people, just the Swedish. The Swedish are never going to have this kind of conflict that we have here in Africa. So I think also, as we are doing our advocacy, we also need to start saying the people who have benefited from conflict diamonds, for example, from coltan trade, from, I don't know, oil or whatever, be forced to put some of the money in the trust fund. I think we need to be creative and innovative in the way we get monies to this trust fund. The people who benefit from conflict, there has to be a way of repatriating some of this money, I think, and putting it back. Maybe those assets which are recovered from abroad can be directed to that kind of trust, because I don't know how they are going to do it, honestly, with the kind of money they have. The last discussion I was involved with at The Hague with the prosecutor, we were discussing community reparations for Northern Uganda. And the discussion was now, you know, the World Bank has built schools and hospitals. Maybe we can buy medicine and call that reparations. That is a discussion. That is the discussion I had. Like Mary, some of those conversations make me very uncomfortable, you know. But so you wonder, do I walk out? Do I ask questions? And there's no Northern Ugandan person there to say, because they have concluded everybody in the camps, 76% of people have HIV/AIDS. So their need for reparations is ARVs, which they will get free from the Clinton Foundation. So you see, you know, we are really put at a, we Africans are put at a very disadvantaged situation, because our own governments are also totally irresponsible. You know, if the World Bank came and built schools in Northern Uganda, the Ugandan government refused to make the schools functioning, because children then are not even going to those schools for fear of being abducted. So it's a difficult question, and I don't have the answers. On the question of participation of witnesses and victims, it is a process which I think they had not fully thought about how many witnesses or victims they would have to deal with, because the process is to provide support, and that support is delineated in two ways. One is the physical safety. So that when they transport you to The Hague, if you're a witness, supposing you're coming from Northern Uganda and you're going to testify in person, they will provide you with an air ticket and somebody to guard you on the way there. Once you're there, you'll be put in a safe house. These are things we have seen happening in Arusha. They didn't all work, by the way. Witnesses have even been killed when they are moving from one point to another. They would provide you with that physical safety. They normally put you in a safe house, which is watched by police. In Arusha, it is Tanzanian guards and UN guards. They provide you with medical care. A lot of witnesses, when they land in the international court, some of them, you know, can't recall events. A lot of them are sick, so they need instant care. A lot of them, it's re-traumatizing, so they need psychological counseling. And now the ICC makes provision for lawyers. And there's a whole process that is described in the statute and in the rules about how they're entitled to, how they can choose that lawyer. Obviously, you're going to be choosing a lawyer who understands Acholi language. What if there's no lawyer who understands Acholi language? Who is going to explain to you what is going on in the court? You know, those are issues for the DRC people. Not all of them speak French. They speak broken Swahili and Lingala. So have they ensured that there are lawyers who speak their language or, you know, whatever language is being spoken? You know, so those are the issues that that the Victims and Witnesses Unit is looking at. That unit is established in a structure of the court known as the registry. And it is staffed by highly, you know, competent people who have expertise in victims' matters, you know, so they are counselors and things like that. So, you know, there's a whole section from Section 68 that explains in great detail, and in the rules of procedure, it also explains every step of the way, so you can get the details from there. Now, going to Lubanga, you know, I really agree with you, Rose. This thing about Lubanga and what kind of a player he was, the ICC is supposed to try those most responsible. Not every person. So they're not going to try the foot soldiers, the people who are doing the killing or the raping or whatever. They are supposed to be trying the planners, the Connies, the Charles Taylors, you know, people like those, the Kabugas. So they're not really going to try every person. As far as I know about this Thomas Lubanga is that he was a member of a militia that committed atrocities in one of these provinces in Ituri, yes. I did not know myself what his rank was or whatever, but he's been tried as a member of that militia. They are making a big fuss of it because it is the first case. You asked how many cases, somebody asked how many cases the ICC has tried. This is the first person they have arrested that has been taken to the ICC. They don't have another person. So, you know, as Rose is calling it, they wanted a fake trial. They actually want a trial because the court has been there since 2002 and they must have a trial. And if Lubanga is there, Lubanga is going to be tried. And if he's going to be tried, we as women must make sure that he's also charged as with rape and other offenses of sexual violence. So, you know, that is the first and only case. Actually, there is no other case. That's the first case.
But Betty, did you say it was referred by the government of the DRC?
Yes.
So how about the Bembas and all these others? You mean they haven't committed atrocities?
Oh, no, they have not been indicted. That's the next point I'm coming to. In Uganda, the court has issued 6 indictments, and I think 6 or 7. One could be under seal, which means you don't know who it is. In the DRC, I don't know how many are under seal, but they are also not more than 11. And I think they are available on the website. You can see them. Bemba is certainly not one of them. Museveni is certainly not one of them, even though he heads UPDF, which committed atrocities. But of course, the atrocities of UPDF are predated to 1987. And that is one of the problems, but their case has been made that UPDF committed atrocities after 2002. You know, so these are the things that create the problems. Now, for the functions, somebody asked a question about the functions of the prosecutor. Yes, the prosecutor is able to investigate on his own motion, on her own motion. And it's provided for in Article 12, I think, where and the prosecutor does not have to take her instructions from a state or an NGO. But, of course, you assume the prosecutor is receiving information from groups such as ourselves or from wherever or from reading and then determine that I'm going to investigate this situation. But that investigation has to be taken before the pretrial chamber before to confirm that it is a situation that requires intervention by the ICC, so that to avoid the mischief of politically motivated cases. And Jessica, the prosecutor who did not do her job properly was Carla Del Ponte. She was the chief prosecutor. She was in charge of both the ICTY and Rwanda. She spent all her time at The Hague, came to Kigali, maybe once every 6 months, stayed for 2 weeks, and went back to The Hague. And obviously the prosecutions at the ICTR suffered. And we saw a slight improvement with the appointment of Jallo, who is now the prosecutor for the ICTR.
But they've left her at the ICTY.
She's still at the ICTY.
So it's like a reward.
She was the chief UN prosecutor. Now, the last question was about money. Somebody asked a question about money? I answered that, yeah, okay. I answered it. So that's done. So we can do the next round. We are starting at the center and going like that.
Thank you for really explicitly presenting, issues on the ICC. But I just wanted to say one thing. In March last year, when we met the chief prosecutor, one of the issues that we put across to him was that, whether he would, whether our national mechanisms, based on both existing legal framework, i.e. the Amnesty Act, and traditional justice and reconciliation systems, would form part of the resource of information that would inform and guide the chief prosecutor in taking a decision to prosecute. And at that time, he seemed to have agreed with the position that we went with. But what we really personally and other, members of the community of Acholi and some parts of Lango and Teso are saying, this ICC is like a mirage of justice. It doesn't really, it will not eventually give us the justice that we so much yearn for. One, the timing. There are many, many heinous crimes that were committed before July 2002, and it hurts us so that only 6 incidences by the LRA will be looked into, whereas various atrocities and massacres like in Atiak, like in Lukung, like in Muchwini, and other parts will not be looked into. So we think, we are resigned to our fate right from the word go. And then secondly, the issue that these perpetrators will be taken to The Hague, kept in good places, like somebody said, on the other hand, the International Criminal Court will try criminals in The Hague in the most conducive environment, with the air-conditioned, self-contained rooms and excellent housing conditions, while the victims have to suffer the consequences of the crimes in IDP camps with no care at all. We think the ICC is a mirage of justice. And I also want to find out, people are wondering as to why suddenly the people are calling out for the traditional means of justice, like the Matoput in the case of the Acholis. It's because we've seen that much as these people will be brought to book, what price can one pay for the massacres that he had committed in Atiak? What sort of compensation will really bring, the people's satisfaction that, yes, justice has been done? And then secondly, they also feel that, the traditional way of resolving conflict is kind of restorative. It builds relationships, and it kind of gives even, the offenders opportunity for reintegration, but that is still questionable as to how the victims will take to that. But most of the people now, as we talk, they are yearning and they are saying government should give opportunity and the ICC should give opportunity for the process of Matoput and other traditional mechanisms to be brought to the fore in resolving this conflict. Because as you said, we don't know even when Kony will be arrested, if he will be arrested. So the more he stays out in the bush, the longer we'll continue suffering. Last but not least, you know, about the other parties that are bringing pressure to bear on the ICC, you've talked about the Refugee Law Project. I don't know whether our women, even from Uganda, have been involved, or other civil society organizations, like our own, the ICC Wiki, UONET, and whatever. I think those ones should also be our voice as women from Uganda. And when we also had a meeting of women peace activists and human rights activists, one of the issues they raised to the ICC was the issue of involvement, of ensuring, asking the ICC to ensure that there are women on the list of legal counsel, so that women victims, stroke survivors from Uganda have the opportunity to be represented by Ugandan women lawyers during ICC proceedings. We know that there are also setbacks, because much as our lawyers can, you know, append their names to that list, there is also a process of what? Of selection. And sometimes they are just knocked off, you know, because of certain criteria that they have put in place. But we would love to have female lawyers to counter what our colleagues from Rwanda faced because of some judges who are not, gender sensitive and made fools of the victims who are witnesses. Otherwise, thank you for the exposition, but we still see this ICC.
Betty, I'd like to begin by thanking you for educating us on the ICC. I personally wish you could stay a little longer and give us more information, but thank you that you came, and thank you for what you have given us. My sister here has asked part of the question I wanted to ask. Maybe I could finish it. Her question was, she talked about the living conditions, the good living conditions of the suspects, the people who are being tried at the ICC. And I want to finish this question by asking, what sort of sentences does the ICC have in mind? Is the ICC planning to send these people away on a five-star luxury holiday so that they can have swimming pool, massage parlor, name it? There are some internet services which the rest of us can't even afford, and yet we are the victims. Is that what the ICC is planning? Because if that is it, then it's not even deterrent. If you tell a rebel leader somewhere that you're going to take them to the ICC, it's okay. So that's my first question. And then I wanted to find out, when exactly has the crime of genocide been committed? The latest example I have in mind is the example of Darfur. Just when Darfur was unfolding, somebody did a cartoon in the Nation newspaper with six parts, and they showed the first part just showed maybe two or three bones and a skull. Then it continued progressively, and somebody was just watching, going from one to another to another. And then when there was a whole mountain of bones and skulls, he said, "Now genocide has happened." And the question is, when exactly has genocide happened? It was happening all this time. What do we need to say genocide has happened? Do we need 5,000 deaths? Do we need 50,000? Or do we need 500,000? When exactly has it happened? And then I have been looking at the definition of genocide, and my immediate reaction is to say, I wish it would be expanded to include people who sit in their expensive carpeted offices in the developed world and fund genocide, even though they don't come to the ground and say this is what needs to be done. But they, for example, the people who supplied machetes to facilitate the genocide in Rwanda, they gave such big quantities of machetes. They knew those machetes were not going to till the ground, but then they gave them anyway. So I just wish that the definition of genocide could be expanded to include people who facilitate genocide, even from a distance. And I don't know where would be a good place to start in having it expanded.
Before you go on, first, just a point of information. When we went with the women to the ICTR in Arusha, we found one of the perpetrators who had been sentenced had been sent to a prison in Mali, but he was going to be moved because it was too hot, and they were mosquitoes there. He didn't like it. it wasn't comfortable enough. And Mary, if you are going to talk about machetes, then what about those that supply the guns that have killed all of us here in Africa? Of course, all these are very, very difficult situations. It's not just the machetes. The other time I was looking at Israel and Lebanon, and the United States supplies every bit of arm that Israel uses. And yet they point such a finger at Iran, which is suspected of developing a nuclear weapon, when they have probably helped Israel already have one very strong one. So these whole questions of justice sometimes are mind-boggling.
Before the microphone is taken away, someone wants to know, does the Marsabit massacre qualify for a genocide? And I think you're very well placed to understand this because you're just around here.
You know, sometimes I start feeling guilty that I wish I hadn't met any of these wonderful women to become excited. But Betty's statement, when she said, sometimes you feel like you want to step aside, made me actually hold back my tears, because I have been asking myself every time I meet in meetings where people are talking about ICC, especially from northern Uganda, I start saying, oh my God, maybe I should not have met Bridget in Brisbane. Because when we met and she was talking about this ICC, I had just finished training in one of the sessions, the documentation. I was so excited. I came back to the office. I was talking about this ICC. I remember Jessica, there was a time I was talking, and Jessica was very busy doing her work, because it was like, what is this woman talking about? I decided to go back to Juliet and saying, we must find a solution. Juliet, you are going to support me in this. And actually, I worked that girl across the coin. Then it came to a time when the initiative was coming to Uganda, and I went to Jane, I went to these members of parliament, telling them, this is our time. The reason was I knew I was going to have, at least I was going to contribute to the healing of my constituency. The constituency that ISIS has worked for a very long time. But now I find myself feeling like a balloon that has been pierced by a pin. Because the time I went, the Women Initiative, which Betty talked about, we went with Betty. I met this gentleman, Ocampo, and he was just there telling me one thing: give me your women. Give me your women to give me the data. And I remember both of us exchanging words, saying, I'm not giving you any woman if she's just coming for you to get data. I even gave him my card, and he refused to get my card. I had already written to him earlier a 4-page letter, and nothing had happened. So when all these things are going on, it makes me so frustrated. But having said that, Betty, it's good you always give me energy to go back to that. But I had totally given up anything called ICC. These days it is Jessica who comes running, and I'm like, I'm not even listening, because I just don't see justice coming. But I have 3 short questions. You talked about safety, which you have explained partly, but I want to find out, is this safety going to follow this woman back to one of the Muchwini villages? I just want to know whether ICC is even going to see her safety there, because that is one of my big problem I had with Ocampo. Secondly, is it possible for the thing you have talked about, reparation, where they know 76% of the people are HIV, AIDS, and so ARVs are the things they need to give them. You and me and the rest of us here know you can only take ARVs if you have a balanced nutrition. So are they packaging it that way? And if they are not, is it possible for this, for us to make an advocacy so that they revisit it? Then lastly, it's also about genocide. About a month ago, when the one of the Ugandans living in New York wrote an article saying Northern Uganda, the case of Northern Uganda is a genocide. When I saw it there, I said, yes, this time I'm going to understand what genocide is. But you kind of said we are not. Please, can you just explain to me whether Northern Uganda situation is a genocide issue? Thank you.
When you talked about the woman in Muchini, I and Betty was talking about relocation. I was wondering, now are you going to take like a woman in from Northern Uganda and take her to Sweden to live there?
For I know that she can't live there because she will say, take me back home. But if she's coming back and she's relocated to Samia land where I come from, of course, Betty, you said people will know this is a stranger. The only solution will be for her to go back to Muchwini. Now, is ICC going to see her safety? So that's another cycle of conflict. That's why I wanted to know that bit.
The other thing I wanted to say, it was said by my sister also from Sudan about Darfur. But what I wanted to add is that in Betty's presentation, she mentioned that any individual, regardless of civilian, military status, or an official position, can be prosecuted. I wanted to know the procedure of prosecution because, like in Southern Sudan, during the war, we know that there was a lot of air bombardment. And then during the peace now, there are people who have come out. Some of them are even Southerners. They were the ones piloting such planes, which were bombarding their people in the South. So in such cases, how do you prosecute such a person? What are the procedures to take such a person to court? Because I'm sure if the person is taken to Khartoum, with the Khartoum government, I don't think there's anything which can be done because the person was employed by that government by that time. That's what I wanted to ask. Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. I think most of it has been very affirming for me because I think we all share this ambivalence that we feel about this international justice. And I think this group is honest enough and experienced enough to say, hey, you know, it doesn't look like it's working for us. And so we need to address it and maybe just put our concerns on the table. When I was listening to you, I was almost shedding tears because what you're saying is really so critical and nobody's listening to that statement. Everybody is like, save Darfur. It has become the sexy new thing, you know? So we will all go and wear the blue helmet and go and march on the street and save Darfur without understanding, you know, what we need to be doing to do that. But let me just do this systematically. The standards of the prisons. The International Tribunal started this trend. The UN has international standards. There are standards that exist in international instruments, which our countries have signed, that say prisoners are supposed to be treated in a certain way. So those people who have been convicted by the ICTR, for example, there are only three countries in Africa which have prisons that conform to international standards. Those three countries are Swaziland, Mali, and one other one which escapes my memory right now. And the first person to be sent to an African prison was John Kambanda, who was the prime minister of the interim government during the genocide. And he complained that the prison in Mali had a lot of mosquitoes, it was hot, it didn't have air conditioning, and therefore he was transferred to Switzerland. Now, the other question, Jane, that is important when you consider those types of sentences is that in European countries, and I'll use Swiss as an example, a life sentence cannot be more than 14 years. Because then that is considered torture or I don't know. Anyway, it is considered it is not supposed to be done to human beings. So a life sentence, unless it states in the sentence that the person is not subject to parole or whatever language they use, a life sentence means 14 years. So all these genocidaires who have been sent for prison terms of 25 years will come out in the next 2 or 3 years, because they had already served time in custody, and then they are going to get rebates for good behavior. And even the ones who have a life sentence will come out in 14 years because none of them has been sentenced to, you know, multiple terms, multiple life terms where they will not, you know, they will have to come out. In fact, the joke about the Arusha Tribunal was that it was the Arusha Hilton. That's what annoyed the victims so much when they went to the tribunal. The survivors would often come up and say to me, you know, do you know what kind of place I'm staying? You know, I'm going to leave that safe house and come and stay with you in your hotel, at Impala Hotel or other places we were staying, because they were living in a place with no curtains, or if the curtains were there, you know, just a bare basics. These people in the prison, in the UN holding facility, are entitled to cell phones, airtime, internet access. They eat meals that I don't eat, me, Betty, in my house every day, because their meals have to be balanced. Every meal has to be balanced with the right amount of protein, starch, veg, fruit, whatever. Every meal. We are not talking dinner or whatever. So those are the things that annoy. But those are international standards. You don't treat prisoners as if they are, you know, less than human. So those are international standards. So, you know, a lot of us would be better off if we were in jail in Switzerland, actually. You know, so that's a reality, and it doesn't matter how annoyed you are going to get. The ICC is not going to send its prisoners to Africa, because anyway, some of our prisons, people will die there, and we are just his advocates. We don't want people to go to Luzira and then survive for 1 week, you know, or some of the Meru prison in Kenya, which is so bad, you know. And I know, but that really annoys people, and you know, Mary's concern about sentences, I think, has been answered. So it and there is no death sentence for international justice. So that was one of Rwanda's problems. By the way, the ICTR was established by the UN General Assembly and the Security Council, but Rwanda itself voted against the establishment of the ICTR because they have the death penalty, and the ICTR does not have the death penalty. So they said, you know, what kind of justice is this? We are sentencing people to death. We believe in the death penalty. And so therefore, you know, they were against it. I mean, personally, I don't believe in the death penalty. But hey, you know, for some people, it works. And, you know, that was one of the reasons that they did not want it. Charles Taylor is another example. Charles Taylor now is at The Hague, but he doesn't like it so much because in Sierra Leone, at the Special Court, which is a UN court, they have better facilities. They have cell phones. They are allowed visits by their families. They have conjugal visits by their wives, which the ICC prison is not allowing, because he's now being held at The Hague awaiting trial there because they decided he was creating instability in Sierra Leone. So he wants to be sent back to Sierra Leone because the cell in Freetown was, you know, very good. You know, they have access to television, to newspapers and things like that. But that's international justice, and I think you just have to live with it. In terms of when is genocide committed, the reason I wanted you to really have this book is so that you can go and read it quietly and see that all the elements that constitute the crime of genocide. In legal terms, and this is a complicated concept, genocide is what is known as a specific intent crime. You have to prove the specific intent to destroy a group. And there are various ways that have been described to destroy that group. One is by killing, like they did to the Tutsis in Rwanda, like they did to the Jews in the 40s. Another is by causing serious bodily or mental harm, like they're doing in Darfur. Bodily harm, when your food is not brought, when you are bombarded with some substances which cause you to have bodily, you don't have to actually die, but there has to be a specific intent to do that harm to those people. A third is genocide by deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about physical destruction, as in the case of Northern Uganda. And I know the statement you're talking about. Olara Otunnu issued that statement in September 2005 when he was accepting his Sydney Peace Prize. He called it by what it was. But he has to show, or anybody saying that there is a genocide in Northern Uganda has to show the specific intent of the Ugandan government to inflict conditions of life on the people of the North that leads to their physical destruction. For example, herding them in camps, making sure that they cannot till their land, creating situations where they're having to live and get diseases such as HIV/AIDS, which is going to kill them in any event because of the way they have been forced to live. You have to show that specific intent. Another element of genocide is by imposing measures intended to prevent births, the sterilization thing. You can poison the water that women drink and therefore impose measures that prevent women from giving birth. And it has been done, by the way. People have been poisoned so that they are not able to have babies. And the last element of genocide is by forcibly transferring children of a particular group. If you don't want to kill them, but you take them from one place and take them to another place, you separate them from their group and go and put them in another group, whether the group is national, ethnic, racial, or religious. Now, you will find those elements described in full and for all the crimes in the document in this booklet that is called The Elements of Crime Documents. It starts on page 70. Moving on to the Masabit massacre, whether it is genocide. Again, this was a massacre that happened that involved two clans, the Gabra and the Marile people. There are two clans which inhabit the northern parts of Kenya. And what they've been doing is they've been fighting each other. The reason it is not genocide is that although 100 people were killed in one night, you will find that that Borana group or whatever it was, the Gabra group, had also inflicted similar injuries on the other group. There is no specific intent by this one group to destroy the other. And if you look at the root of that conflict in the north, you will discover that even from just examining the root of the conflict, it will not give rise to you concluding that that was a genocide. With regard to charging perpetrators, even the economic financiers of genocide, that is why Kabuga is being sought. Because Kabuga supplied the weapons, created the radio. He owned the RTLM radio that was, urging people to finish the job and, fill the graves. These were financiers of instruments that were important for the genocide. But I think the key point was that, what about the Kenyan businessman who imported those machetes? The machetes came through Kenya, by the way. We heard about it in the Goldenberg hearings when somebody said they had imported they were importing machetes from England. And then there was no questioning about what happened to them after they came to Kenya. So they went to Rwanda. But at the same time, the Egyptian government was supplying guns to the Rwandan government between 1992 and 1994. The Egyptian government, who is not the normal supplier of weapons. So, that raises the questions about accountability for some of these crimes for international actors who may not be Rwandans themselves, who were not involved in the plotting. Maybe these people can be charged in their own countries. Like, for example, I think the importer of those machetes, the Kenyan importer, ought to explain, somebody needs to ask those questions anyway.